Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with arguments before the Supreme Court in McCutcheon versus the FEC that could strike down any remaining limits on spending on candidates and parties. Senator Bernie Sanders, who was in the Supreme Court and later spoke on the steps afterwards, joins us to discuss whether the court will further empower a few billionaires like those behind the Tea Party shutdown, who are radically altering the American political landscape, moving the country further and further to the right. Then we'll speak with Princeton historian Sean Wilentz, who has an article in Monday's New York Times, Obama and the Debt, which points out that the 14th Amendment was intended to prevent precisely the abuses that the current House Republicans blithely condone. We will discuss how the Republican Party made payment of our debts part of their 1868 platform, declaring that national honor requires the payment of the public indebtedness in the utmost good faith to all creditors at home and abroad, pronouncing any repudiation of the debt a national crime. Then finally, we examine the role of the U.S. Catholic bishops in encouraging the House Republicans to take the current hostage-taking course, while at the same time expressing their concern for the record rate of 1 in 5 children in poverty, as well as the 49 million Americans who are food insecure. Adele Stan, who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics as RH Reality Check's senior Washington correspondent, joins us to discuss her latest article, At Any Cost, How Catholic Bishops Pushed for a Shutdown and Even a Default Over Birth Control. And joining us now is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the United States Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He's the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Sanders.
Good to be with you.
And, Senator, you were on the steps of the Supreme Court after having gone into the court to hear the oral arguments in McCutcheon versus the FEC. Let's start with the actual oral arguments. To your mind, who equipped themselves the best? Those on McCutcheon's side, the millionaire who...
Well, to my mind, and this is actually the very first time that I have been to an argument in the Supreme Court, so it was kind of interesting. But to my mind, it really was unworldly in the sense that I'm not quite sure that all of these guys on the Supreme Court have a sense in terms of what happens in the real world politically. In the real world, what we are seeing right now is the devastating impact of big money on the political process, made even worse by Citizens United. And if this court case goes in favor of big money, it will only make a very, very bad situation a lot worse. What you'll see is the end of limitations in terms of the ability of big money just to even spend more than they currently are.
So given the extent to which Citizens United has already changed the landscape, did you get any sense, Senator Sanders, that any of these conservative justices know what that ruling has wrought?
I'm not sure. Certainly not Scalia. Not Alito. Who knows? Maybe maybe the Chief Justice, maybe Roberts, may have some understanding. But I think these guys, in fact, are really separated from what goes on. Right now, let me just give you one example, Ian, which people should know about. As everybody knows, we're in the midst of this horrendous government shutdown. What people don't know is one of the reasons that this has not yet ended is in the House right now, you have House members, the extreme right wing, who are telling other members that if they are prepared to vote for a clean, continuing resolution, they will face a primary and they will face a unlimited amount of money in opposition to them. And that's what Citizens United is all about. So you stand up and you try to do maybe the right thing, in this case, open up the government. And what you're going to be faced with is, you know, people like the Koch brothers and others who have huge amounts of money who are prepared to spend millions to defeat you. This is undermining American democracy, and to give even more ability to big money people to influence the political process is beyond comprehension.
Well, I must say I find it extraordinary, Senator Sanders, that three individuals, David and Charles Koch and Rupert Murdoch, combined have moved this country so far to the right in the last few decades, it's breathtaking. And the idea that a couple of billionaires with almost unlimited funds can set up this mechanism that terrorizes, in fact, it is a form of terrorism, that terrorizes moderate...
You make a great point, and that is the point, and that's what Citizens United has done. And what we're looking at, and people should understand this, and I've been trying to make this point on the floor of the Senate, is if anybody thinks that this is just about the Affordable Care Act, about Obamacare, and trying to defund that, they would be sorely mistaken. This is part of the extreme right-wing agenda, which essentially wants to repeal every major piece of legislation passed in the last 80 years, which protect the interest of working people, the elderly, the children, the sick, the poor, the environment. That's what they want to do. And the difficulty of these so-called negotiations right now, or the debate right now, is that if you submit it to this blackmail, I will guarantee you 100% that they will be back again and again. And maybe next time they will say, well, you know what? We're going to shut down the government unless you make drastic cuts in Social Security or you privatize it. Or we're going to shut down the government unless you repeal the minimum wage or you do away with the Environmental Protection Agency. They have a right-wing agenda which calls for bringing this country back into the 1920s, moving us to an oligarchic form of society where the people like Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers and a few other billionaires really control the economics and politics of this nation. That is what this whole process is about.
And it would seem that the rubric by which they're operating is the sky is falling over the deficits, and the deficits are just a stalking horse to
absolutely
reduce the taxes on the rich, isn't it?
Yeah. Look, here's what the point. The truth of the matter is that we have reduced the deficit from about $1.4 trillion to $700 billion in the last few years. What is, if you go up to the average person in California, Vermont, or any place else, and you say, what do you see the major domestic problem facing America? What do they say overwhelmingly in every single poll done in the last many years? What they say, it is jobs and the economy. That's what people say. Real unemployment today is not 7.4%. It is close to 14%. Youth unemployment is a lot higher than that. African-American youth unemployment is close to 40%. Wages have gone down for tens of millions of American workers who in many cases are working longer hours for lower pay. What people are saying is we need an economy in which we have decent paying jobs and we have enough jobs so that people are not facing unemployment. That is the issue that people are concerned about. Is the deficit important? Yeah, it is. And we've made some progress in that deficit in the last few years. People want us to focus now on the economy. And when we're caught up in all of this stuff, there is no discussion about how we create millions of jobs, no discussion about how we raise the minimum wage, no discussion about how we make college more affordable, and how we address the real serious issues facing the middle class.
And again, I'm speaking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He's the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, and today he attended the arguments in McCutcheon versus the FEC at the Supreme Court and later spoke on the steps of the Supreme Court, where you said, Senator Sanders, freedom of speech, in my view, does not mean the freedom to buy the United States government. And what was the response from the people there?
Well, the people that I spoke to who are actively involved in the issue of campaign finance reform obviously agreed. And I think most Americans do. It's, you know, this is one of the interesting issues where you have conservatives, you have progressives, you have moderates, Democrats, Republicans, independents coming together. You go out on the streets and you say, do you think it's okay for people like the Koch brothers who are worth $70 billion to be able to spend hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars deciding who's going to be the governor of Wisconsin, who's going to be president of the United States, who's going to be in the United States Senate here, what the legislative agenda will be in the United States Congress, and people say, you're nuts. That's absurd. That's crazy. That's not what a democracy is about. And they're right. Nobody believes this makes sense. except the billionaires who want to have more power and whose greed appears to be never-ending.
But, of course, the billionaires, the constituents of these Tea Party Congress people who are both shutting down the government at the moment and threatening to tank the economy, they in many ways support their representatives based upon, in effect, economic illiteracy. One of the arguments out now is that the debt ceiling is not that important. I'm astounded, frankly, that Wall Street hasn't weighed in some more. There's quite a lot of very, very senior analysts on Wall Street who are very complacent, saying, oh, this is never going to happen. The chance of a default is zero. You're there on the Hill. I don't have that sense that these people are bluffing.
Well, I think you may very well be right. We'll find out soon enough. I think what you have is a couple of things. What you're looking at is people should not see this as a debate over Obamacare. This is a huge ideological debate by the extreme right wing who want to repeal virtually every major piece of legislation passed in the last 8 years. So they certainly do not want to see the federal government playing a role in providing health insurance today to people who don't have it. But much more than that, they want to end Medicare as we know it right now, move it into a voucher program. They want to make massive cuts in Medicaid. They don't want Medicaid expanded. They want to make Medicaid decimated. These guys want to end Social Security. Ian, these guys, and they're upfront about it. They're upfront about it. People don't know this. You know, we're having a debate right now in Congress, or at least some of us are supporting legislation to raise the minimum wage because we think we have tens of millions of workers who are making less than $10 an hour, can't raise a family, starvation wages. Do you know what the majority of the Republicans now in Congress believe in terms of the minimum wage? Do you know what they believe?
What?
For them, it is not a question of whether or not you raise the minimum wage. They believe we should abolish the concept of the minimum wage. So that in a high unemployment area in the United States, say Detroit, or some other high unemployment area, if somebody was desperate enough to have to work for $3 or $4 an hour, our right-wing friends see that as freedom because we've gotten the government out of the business of putting a floor on wages. That an employer can hire an employee for any wage that both of them agree to. Isn't that just what freedom is all about? And if in America people are working for $3, $4 an hour, isn't that great? That's what these guys believe. That's true. I mean, and this is what many, many members, Republican members of the United States Congress believe. That's their understanding of freedom. So what people have got to appreciate is this stuff is a lot more than Obamacare. What this stuff is an extremist right-wing agenda funded by people like the Koch brothers and others who want to really create an America in their vision, which is really an oligarchic type of society where a few people on top have unbelievable control over the political process and the economy as well.
And that's where we're heading if we're not already there. I mean, I understand the motives of the Koch brothers. They don't want a government. They don't want anybody telling them what to do. But why would American people think that total laissez-faire economy run by oligarchs would in any way benefit them? That's the part that I find...
That's a good question, worthy of a longer discussion than we have time for now. But it has to do with, among other things, the lack of a strong labor movement in America, which is clearly being targeted by these very same people. It has to do with a corporately owned media, so that if you live in many states in this country where you have right-wing political leadership, you're never going to hear a progressive point of view. You're never going to learn that the United States, for example, is the only country in the industrialized world that doesn't guarantee health care to all people as a right. How many people in America even know that? You know, the I hear right now, Obamacare, which is, in my view, kind of a moderate Republican-type approach, which expands health insurance to 20, 25 million Americans, still leaving 25 million without health insurance, by the way. We are behind, with Obamacare, we're still behind every other major country. How many American people even know that? How many people know that we spend twice as much per person on health care as do the people of any other major country with worse health outcomes in many respects. So we are a country where political consciousness is not terribly high, and that's a combination of very effective work done by the right wing, a corporately controlled media, a weak labor movement, and a Democratic Party, which is certainly not doing the kinds of things it needs to be doing in standing up for working people and putting the Republicans on the defensive. I mean, in that regard, one of the things that I am fighting for here is to see if we can change the rules here in the Senate so we don't need 60 votes for at least a few month period and push through some serious legislation which creates jobs, which raises wages, which really deals with the crisis of college affordability, which deals with equal pay for equal rights, which deals, in fact, moving toward a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. So the American people have got to see that there is some action by some people that is trying to defend their interests. And I'm afraid in many cases they don't, and they don't pay attention, and the Koch brothers and those guys can just keep going.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Senator Sanderson, for fighting the good fight, and hopefully people listening to us will recognize that they have to join this fight before they lose their country.
That's exactly correct. Ian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the United States Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, and today he attended the oral arguments in the Supreme Court in the case of McCutcheon versus the FEC and later spoke on the steps of the Supreme Court. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the Republicans originally brought forth the 14th Amendment, saying any repudiation of the debt is a national crime.
It's the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sean Wilentz, a professor of history at Princeton University, where he's taught since 1979. He is a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and his latest, Bob Dylan in America. He has an article in Monday's New York Times, Obama and the Debt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Wilentz.
Great to be here, Ian.
And in your article in the New York Times, let's start with the actual language of the 14th Amendment, because I think it's pretty stark and unambiguous. The 14th Amendment states that the validity of the public debt of the United States, authorized by law, is sacrosanct and shall not be questioned. So it's obviously that message is entirely missed on John Boehner and the House Republicans.
Well, yes, it is, Ian. I mean, the quotation read that actually from my piece. It's not quite, but you got it basically right.
Right.
It's clear, unambiguous. It was in the aftermath of the Civil War, really to protect the country from exactly what the Republicans are doing now, which is using the public debt for partisan purposes. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly lost on John Boehner. I wish everyone would point out, commentators like yourself, the President of the United States, Harry Reid, everyone, would point out that what the Republicans, or some Republicans, are proposing to do violates the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. I mean, saying that as clearly as that, clarifying the constitutional issues, I think, would make a big difference in this crisis.
Well, of course, the president had an opportunity at his press conference to say that. It was a long press conference. And in your article, Sean Wilentz, in the New York Times, Obama and the Debt, you point out that the president is influenced by legal scholar Lawrence Tribe, who taught President Obama at Harvard Law School, who 2 years ago insists that, quoting, the only political courage and compromise can avert a default disaster like the one that we're facing on October the 17th. Now, right. Let's face it, the word compromise is a dirty word in the Tea Party lexicon.
Well, I mean, there's not going to be any compromising with these people. I actually have another piece coming out later in the week in Rolling Stone magazine where I go through the whole history of what this Congress has done. And I think, in fact, that the president and the people around him actually misjudged this Congress when they, tried to push for a postpartisan policy. In pushing for postpartisan politics, that was never in the cards as far as this Congress was concerned. This Congress has basically had to destroy him. And I think he figured that out the last time we went all through all of this in 2011. If you notice, his campaign in 2012 did not have all of that postpartisan stuff in it. It was a much more classically liberal campaign. But be that as it may, we're in a situation where, once again, we're in a standoff and we have to figure out some way to get through it.
I'm actually surprised, Sean Wilentz, about the role of Wall Street. The president clearly signaled to Wall Street to help him out with the Republicans and to give them a reality check.
Right.
And there's a lot of people on Wall Street that are extremely complacent and basically saying there's zero chance of this happening. And I don't take those assurances with any comfort because I don't think you're necessarily dealing with economically literate people in the House, and I think you're dealing with people who are quite determined and quite zealous, and I'm not sure that they are bluffing.
Well, I mean, if you go on the conservative, let alone right-wing blogs, you'll find all sorts of people coming out and saying, no, this debt ceiling business is no problem, default's nowhere near, not going to cost us anything. Actually, the president spoke to this quite forcefully, I think, today in his press conference. I mean, that's just crazy. There are all sorts of claims that there's enough money there to pay off the bondholders, and therefore there will be no default. Well, the bondholders are part of the debt, sure, and they'll pay them off, but there will be plenty of other people that won't get paid. So, but quite apart from the economic consequences, it will be fundamentally a violation of the Constitution. And no matter what you think about the economics, and they're crazy about it, that issue, I think, is crystal clear.
Again, I'm speaking with Sean Wilentz, a professor of history at Princeton University, where he has taught since 1979. He is a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and his latest, Bob Dylan in America. He has an article in Monday's New York Times, Obama and the Debt. So it's a bit of an irony, as you point out in your article, Sean Wilentz, that the Republican Party back in 1868 in its party platform said about the debt is that, quoting, national honor requires the payment of the public indebtedness in the utmost good faith to all creditors at home and abroad, and pronouncing any repudiation of the debt as a national crime.
Right.
That's a hell of a good line. I wish Obama would use that.
Well, it would be useful. I mean, it was... The Republican Party then was, we have to switch around the labels, the Republican Party then was the party of the Union coming out of the Civil War. But they believed quite clearly what the situation was, that there were Northern Democrats who were in a position to try and repudiate part of the debt by paying it back in depreciated paper money called the greenbacks. And the Republicans, seeing that, seeing that it would be an attack on the government's credibility and therefore on the economy, that's why they put this section in the 14th Amendment. So it's the Republican Party then, the Republican Party now. Now the Democrats are the Republicans, in effect.
So do you think then that absent compromise and courage, as Lawrence Tribe has suggested, the only solutions to this situation, what about, as you point out, Abraham Lincoln in a national crisis invokes emergency powers? Is that a possible route if indeed we go over the cliff?
Well, if we go over the cliff, I think that there's room for this. Now, there's a great deal of disagreement about what would happen, but there are two ways of looking at it. First of all, the president has an independent responsibility to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's his oath of office. If we go over the cliff, the Congress, the House of representatives, but the Congress will have violated the Constitution of the United States. So, I mean, it seems on that basis that he would be duty-bound to do something, if only to uphold this oath of office and protect the Constitution of the United States. And then, you know, raise the debt limit, you know, summarily. There are those who say that, therefore, no one would buy those Treasury bonds. I'm not sure what to make of that argument yet. But aside from all of that, I mean, if, in fact, the market started melting down, you would be in an emergency. And, you know, much as, you know, Lincoln did with in the early phases of the American Civil War, you know, he would have to invoke emergency powers in order to prevent the general welfare from just being destroyed. There's also a question of whether he could then go back to the Congress. Lincoln went back to the Congress to get approval after he suspended habeas corpus. But, you know, that's another issue that has to be dealt with down the line. In the end, the president is not powerless in the situation, I believe. I think he has some powers to deal with it.
So as a historian, though, Sean Mullins, clearly in the nation's early years, the press was largely independent, shall we say, and quite vigorous, and they routinely slandered each other in ways that are fairly colorful. But do you recall, probably since Andrew Jackson, a president being treated with such disrespect? I mean, it's really affecting, and he brought it out in his press conference. In fact, he was asked about this, about not showing up for the APEC summit. And after all, this is the president who touted a pivot towards Asia, and he's not there. The Chinese are dominating the summit, and Putin is making snide remarks about, you know, this is no way to run a railroad. So obviously the anti-democratic leaders like Putin and the Chinese president are having fun at America's expense. But it seems to me that in their contempt, which is often irrational for this president, they don't understand that by extension they're hurting America, that yeah. You cannot separate the president from the presidency.
Well, that point can't be made too strongly, Ian. I mean, by raising this particular kind of crisis, too, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of political jockeying going on. But basically, they're holding a gun to his head and say, you know, as Lincoln said, you know, like, stand and deliver, give me your purse or I'll shoot you, and you'll be the murderer. You'll be responsible for it. Going back to 2010, I mean, the vilification of the president in that midterm campaign was as great as I was as nasty as I've seen in modern times. I mean, they got pretty rough in the 19th century. You know, they called Andrew Jackson all sorts of terrible things. But things have changed since then, and what I saw in 2010 was just remarkable. And, you know, yes, I think you're right. There's a detestation of Obama that I haven't seen really since Bill Clinton, when they detested Bill Clinton so much. It may be that they detest any Democrat who's in the White House, that any Democrat is, in their mind, illegitimate. But it's part of why I just don't think that there's much room for compromise here.
But in Clinton's case, of course, they used, extreme extrajudicial means to try and remove him.
Yes, through
an impeachment, which was, basically a trumped-up fishing expedition that didn't find anything until they found a stain on a dress. And,
right.
You know, and obviously the guy was keeping a secret from his wife.
Right.
And yeah, what's his name? Ken Starr became the sort of nation's pornographer in chief.
Exactly. Well, but you see, even with that stain on the dress, it was not an impeachable offense. It was an unconstitutional impeachment. And they went about doing it anyway without, you know, a constitutional fig leaf to that, so that the bar for impeachment has been lowered.
That's what will happen, though, Sean?
If
he invokes the 14th Amendment, won't they scream impeachment?
They probably will. But the question is how he does it. If he goes about doing it in a constitutional way, if he simply invokes the 14th Amendment and does it summarily before there's any default, I think it would be unwise, because I think the separation of powers, which, funnily enough, you know, he's trying to stop an unconstitutional Congress by acting in that way, he in fact will be acting unconstitutionally, because the separation of powers is also clear that the president cannot interfere with the power of the purse in any way, shape, manner, or form. It's the Congress has that power. It's only in the case of an emergency, I think, that he can step in, which would happen if the Congress indeed went through with its violation of the Constitution and caused, a financial meltdown. That's a very different situation.
So, again, another question for an historian. How different is it now in terms of, one of the ironies that I find in the current situation, Sean Wilentz, is that a small group of very right-wing Tea Party people, and they're often called radicals, and I've gotten some mail from listeners saying, don't use the word radical. That's a noble term.
These
people are reactionaries. So being careful about how I label them, there's nevertheless a very small group, and yet they're holding the entire country hostage and arguably the world economy hostage.
Yes. Yes.
You have the so-called sensible center, where most Americans are supposed to be in the political lexicon. They're absolutely irrelevant now. Anybody that's talking about bipartisanship is living in a fool's paradise. And then you have the political left that's absent. So what's going on?
Oof, that's a big question, Ian. Let's take it one by one. In the case of what's going on the right or in the Republican Party, it's pretty clear that a failure of leadership, that's a decay in the leadership that's gone on really since Reagan left office, has left the Republican Party captive to this very, very vigorous and, I should add, well-funded minority. Without the funding of people like the Koch brothers and Jim DeBint and his Heritage Foundation, and others, Freedom Works, Dick Armey's operation, these guys would not be anywhere near as powerful as they are. What they have is the power to remove people, in a sense, impeach them in a funny way by elections, by running primaries against them, so that if anybody steps out of line, they're in danger of losing their seat. That's how they operate, and it's really quite vicious. And even within the House conference, the House Republican caucus, Boehner is basically powerless. He said it first, announced publicly that he was not going to let Obamacare get in the way of a continuing resolution. Then he came out of the meeting and said, "Well, Obamacare is going to be part of the continuing resolution." And they asked him, "Well, what changed?" And he said something to the effect of, "Well, sometimes a leader has to listen." Leaders don't listen in that regard. Leaders lead. He was basically undone by these people, and he's been undone all the way through. So basically you have, yes, this minority has managed to finagle away with the help of all that money to basically hold the Republican Party captive and then hold the nation, as you say, and then the world. On the other side, the left, it's the Democrats are doing the best they can, and I know that there are divisions there about how to go about doing this. The White House has one strategy. The Senate has another strategy. The question is whether they're going to be able to stand up to this kind of blackmail and this kind of hostage-taking, which, even as centrist, impeccably centrist writers such as Norman Ornstein and Thomas E. Mann, who did a book on the subject, have pointed out there's almost a pathology, an ideological outlier is how they describe the Republican Party today. The question is, what do you do with it? How do you deal with it? And I think that the idea of trying to compromise or trying to find some way to undermine them sneakily is not going to work. I think that in the end, there has to be a confrontation, and they have to be undone. Not unlike the way that Clinton undid Gingrich in 95, 96. He basically outfoxed him. There's lots of different ways to do it. But, something has to be done to stand up to these guys, or else they're going to keep on going and going and going.
Well, it does seem, though, that there is something else going on here. And earlier in the program, I was speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders, who went to the oral arguments today at the Supreme Court in McCutcheon versus the FEC and spoke on the steps of the Supreme Court afterwards. And the point being that McCutcheon, if the Supreme Court rules the way they've ruled on Citizens United, is going to remove one of the last impediments to millionaires and billionaires buying our politicians, which they seem to be doing wholesale in any case. And it seems to me that just these two brothers, the Koch brothers,
right.
and I guess if you add them with the Australian export, Rupert Murdoch, those three individuals have moved this country further to the right in the last few decades than I think could even anybody could have predicted. And the Koch brothers are doing it, and they're behind much of what's happening now. And the New York Times did a piece on it the other day saying
right.
that essentially because they are using their money as a weapon, they're terrifying these guys on the Tea Party side that they will fund somebody even more to the right of
right.
the incumbent unless you step to their tune. And so that has the effect of moving the goalposts continually to the right, and that's...
Well, that's right. That's the game. You know, it used to be that rich people bought congressmen, you know, back in the Gilded Age, and you bribed them or something. This is a somewhat different dynamic. This is terrorism. They're terrorizing the moderates and eliminating as many as they can and terrorizing the rest. And the terror is simply that, yes, they will be hit with a primary. Now, that said, there are still 15, 20 Republicans who are in Republican districts near where I am now, near Princeton, New Jersey, up in Philadelphia, down in Philadelphia. There are a number of Republican congressmen who have broken, have called for a clean, extension resolution. Because their districts, a Tea Party person will not do well there. It's a Republican district, but it's a moderate Republican district. There are still some of those. The problem is they don't, the question is how many of them are there? Is there enough there to combine with the Democrats to get something through? There probably is. But then, if Speaker Boehner goes that direction, he's got to worry about his own job because he'll most likely be overthrown by the Republican caucus.
So well, but what's despicable about that? In order to keep his job, he's putting hundreds of thousands of Americans out of work.
Yeah, you be the judge of that. Yes.
That's a fact.
Right.
I mean, it's not
absolutely. I'm just saying yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, and the other thing that I found extraordinary, by the way, just in terms of rampant hypocrisy, was when that mentally ill woman was shot on the Capitol and they did a lockdown, which is a routine they have where they Capitol Police grab all the congresspeople and send them into a safe room.
Right.
After that incident, once everybody came up for air and it was settled, the House then took to the floor and congratulated the Capitol Hill Police on what they'd just done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without mentioning the fact that these same guys that saved them or protected them are being furloughed.
Yeah. Big government is a terrible thing until you need it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Sean Wilentz.
Ian, it was a real pleasure. See you again soon.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Sean Wilentz, a professor of history at Princeton University, where he's taught since 1979. He's a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and his latest is Bob Dylan in America. He has an article in Monday's New York Times, Obama and the Debt. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the role of the U.S. Catholic bishops in encouraging the House Republicans in their current reckless course.
All my funds are gone and the bank says no. I beg in the places where I used to be. And I'm crazy for cash, but I ain't got none. Oh, I'm just
but they'll make it a privilege, not a right, accessible only to the rich. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves, because life don't stop after birth. And for a child born to the unprepared, it might even just get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebombing clinics.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is RH Reality Check's senior Washington correspondent and just wrote the article, At Any Cost, How Catholic Bishops Pushed for a Shutdown and Even a Default over Birth Control. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And it's extraordinary at a time where the new pope has spoken out against the obsession, as he referred to it, of abortion that has gripped the Catholic Church and called upon the bishops to be much more pastoral and to go out and toil in the fields of the Lord as opposed to living in their palaces with their servants and limousines. And the Pope has set an example by eschewing all of those trappings. Mm-hmm. And recently he went to celebrate St. Francis of Assisi, whose name he's taken. So I don't understand, and I spoke the other day to Sister Simone Campbell, who was singled out by the Catholic bishops for
by the previous pope
over the very issue that this new pope is saying, you know, we should forget about or de-emphasize.
De-emphasize, I think, is the correct term.
Yes.
Yeah.
So now we learn from your reporting that these same Catholic bishops here in the United States have been weighing in behind the scenes, and obviously since John Boehner is a practicing Catholic, and so is Paul Ryan, the head of the Budget Committee,
right,
it would seem that they have some influence on the House. So tell me what they're up to.
Well, what the bishops have been up to is, and they've been up to this for a while, is they object quite vehemently to the birth control benefit that is part of the Affordable Care Act, Ian. And that benefit, it makes employers have to provide, if they provide insurance plans to their employees, and we have to remember most employees contribute to the cost of those plans, right? So if they provide insurance plans to their employees, those plans have to cover, under the preventive care provisions, contraception that is, prescription contraception has to be covered. And it has to be covered without a deductible and without a copayment, so that no woman is prevented by her economic circumstances from getting the birth control method that is most appropriate for her, including sterilization is also a part of the coverage. But, you know, your mundane, usual methods, birth control pills, IUDs, all that would be covered. So the bishops have a real problem with this. It doesn't matter that houses of worship are exempt as far as they are concerned. They do not want the less religiously oriented institutions that are affiliated with the church to have to do this. And the administration made an and that would include like hospitals and universities and that kind of thing. The administration made an accommodation whereby these institutions would not have to buy this, would not have to pay for this coverage themselves. They got an agreement with the insurance companies that the insurance companies would then provide the coverage for free. Why? Because it's a lot cheaper to cover birth control than it is to cover a pregnancy. So it's in their interest. So that's the backstory. Well, the bishops are having none of it, even with the accommodation. And so they have crafted this argument around so-called religious liberty. They're claiming that this violates their religious liberty. And they're calling not only for their institutions to be exempted from this requirement, but any private business whose owners believe that the use of contraception contradicts their religious belief. They should be able to opt out entirely from allowing their employees, at no cost to them, the employer, to have birth control through these plans. So that's what we're up against. And the bishops are saying this is a violation of their religious liberty. Never mind that the religious liberty of any woman who would be prescribed a contraceptive, you know, would be impeded upon by being, you know, not allowed to access this benefit. So that's where we are. And the bishops are so adamant about this, Ian. They were willing to shut down the government in order to make a play to get some kind of relief from it.
And are they also ready to destroy the economy by defaulting on the debt?
That it would definitely seem that way from the letter that they sent. They sent a letter to bishops, Sean Cardinal O'Malley, who's the Archbishop of Boston, and Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore. They both head different committees of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, which is also known as the Bishops' Lobby. And so they sent this letter to all members of Congress that made the case that that they think that it should be attached to some kind of, quote-unquote, must-pass legislation. And that can be either the government shutdown, the what they call the continuing resolution, which would have kept the government open, or it can mean the debt ceiling, which a second letter sent by another group of bishops referenced as being endangered by the lack of some kind of conscience clause for religious business owners and institutions on this particular measure. So what happened was, if your listeners recall, there was, you know, one continuing resolution that was passed through the GOP-led House that attached an amendment that would have totally defunded Obamacare. Well, you know, that was done as a poison pill, knowing if the Senate would never accept that, they stripped out that part. We had Ted Cruz's filibuster, his fake filibuster. It went back to the House. Time is running out. The October 1 deadline for a shutdown, unless they pass this continuing resolution, is happening. It's coming on close. And on September 26th, the bishops then sent this letter saying, hey, you know, we think that this Conscience Rights Act that you guys have already crafted should be attached. Well, GOP didn't go quite that far. What they did was they attached an amendment that would have delayed this benefit, as well as other screenings for preventive screenings for women, including screenings for HPV virus, and which causes cervical cancer, all kind of stuff, would be attached, knowing that that would also be stripped out by the Senate, and that by the time that got back to the House, the government would shut down. And, you know, what does that do? That shut down the Women, Infants, Children nutritional program, or at least put it in jeopardy. It shut down a number of Head Start centers where little children of limited means go to school. It did all kinds of bad things for regular people.
Again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who is a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is RH Reality Check's senior Washington correspondent and just wrote the article, At Any Cost, How Catholic Bishops Push for a Shutdown and Even a Default Over Birth Control. But as your article points out, Adele Stan, the whole passage of the Affordable Care Act hung in the balance. And, of course, as we know, it was passed, and it was passed in both houses, signed by the president and upheld by the Supreme Court. But going back to the passage in the House at the last minute, Representative Joe Pitts, a Republican of Pennsylvania, and former Democratic Congressman Bart Stupak, the bishops weighed in on them to try and derail it over the same issue, even though the Hyde Amendment...
That was actually over abortion, not...
Right, over abortion. And irrespective of the fact that the Hyde Amendment is the law of the land. And I recall at that point, it was the nuns who weighed in and saved us, right? Or saved the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I mean, you could see it that way. And this is why I think, and this has long been my theory, why the bishops really have it in for Obama, because he showed that that they do not have the power over their flock. Because the Catholic people stood behind these women religious who, as individuals, signed on to a letter that said that they found the Affordable Care Act, as constructed, to be acceptable. And part of that construction made it very, very clear that, you know, no federal subsidies would be used for abortion coverage, and that women would have to cover, you know, would have to purchase separate coverage if they wanted coverage for abortion, and they would have to pay for that out of their own pockets. And so they found that acceptable. The Catholic Health Association, headed by Sister Carol, I forget her name now, but they found it acceptable. And then that gave Obama sort of Catholic bona fides to go before the people and say, see, you know, the people you love and respect in your church, because nuns always poll much higher among Catholics than bishops.
Well, they actually do the Lord's work. I mean,
they're
where the rubber meets the road.
Teaching the children and all of that. Yeah.
Well, now, isn't that, though, that's being used rather cynically here? And there's another letter that you mentioned in your article, Adele Stan, from the Bishop's Lobby, signed by Bishop Stephen Blair of Stockton, California, Archbishop Jose Gomez of Los Angeles, and Bishop Richard Pates of Des Moines. They're stating their concern over the high rates of poverty in the U.S., the 1 in 5 children who are poor and hungry, and the 49 million Americans who experienced food insecurity over the last year. And, of course, you know, the Republicans are trying to eviscerate the food stamp program, make the poor subject to drug tests, etc. So there is clearly a war on the poor going on the Republican right. But these bishops, while expressing concern for the least among us, are tying that to this jihad against birth control.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like they're crying crocodile tears. You know, on the one hand, they are saying, isn't this horrible? All of these things are hanging in the balance, and we are so concerned about, you know, these 1 in 5 children who are living in poverty and the growing inequality. But it's you, Democrats, essentially, is what the subtext is, who are putting it all in jeopardy because you refuse to include conscience provision on this birth control measure. And it's, you know, it's just bizarre to me. I mean, it makes it very, very clear to me, Ian, that, you know, no bishop has ever had to face an unplanned pregnancy. No bishop has ever had to face the terror and blood and pain of a problem pregnancy. No bishop has ever had to wonder how to feed his children, at least in theory. So, you know, we're talking about an institution that discriminates against women in the most primitive way in its very leadership structure and justifies it through a theology, where most Christian denominations long ago abandoned that kind of discrimination.
Well, and there are, of course, the women religious within the Catholic Church who pushing for the ordination of women. If priests were to marry, the very thing that you just said, Adele Stan, would go away, that the priests, you know, if they were able to marry and their daughter got pregnant, they might have a completely different view of abortion.
Sure. If you see your wife, you're sitting in a labor room with your wife, you know, going through a very difficult, life-threatening pregnancy, you know. I mean, it's a whole major aspect of the human experience that they don't have.
So do you think that Boehner and Ryan and company have now a kind of religious sanction to go to the mat? If the bishops are saying, you know, bless you, my child, you're free to screw the government, shut down the government, and destroy the economy for the greater good?
Yes, I do. I think that that is what the bishops have afforded them by sending these letters, because there is no other reason for the second letter that were sent by the one we just talked about that referenced all of these terrible things that are befalling the least among us. There's no other reason for that letter because the shutdown was already imminent at the time that they wrote it, other than to give these guys cover should they shut down the government or should they force the default of the federal government on the debt ceiling fight, which is fast upon us.
So, in fact, I remember asking Sister Simone Campbell when she was we were talking to her recently about the Pope's remarks on the church being obsessed with abortion, and where he made kind remarks about gays and lesbians and seemed to indicate that the church should shift its focus away from its obsession with abortion and gay marriage and contraception and start reviving its core mission of dealing with the poor and standing up for social justice. And
right.
So that was relatively recently that I spoke to her, and I said to her, I said, do you think that these same cardinals, and particularly these bishops here in the United States who are writing this letter to their to Boehner and Paul Ryan, et cetera, do you think those that chose this new pope have buyer's remorse? And she thought that was kind of funny. But what do you think is going on there? How are these people, like the bishops that signed this letter, you know, O'Malley and company and the Laurie and the guy in New York who's a real hardliner, hail fellow, well-met hardliner, how are they dealing with what the Pope is saying? Are they going to listen to him? Are they going to stop living in their palaces and having their fine wines and having little Filipino nuns give them pedicures? I mean,
well, you know, I kind of doubt that. And I don't think that Francis has reiterated his remarks that he made, you know, speaking to the Jesuit publication where he talked about the obsession with abortion and the harsh tone towards LGBT people. I think that, you know, that was something that happened once. If he wants to see any kind of change, he's going to have to repeat that message quite a lot if he wants to see any change at the U.S., in the U.S. Church. However, I do think it was aimed. I do totally think it was aimed at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. So what I would imagine is, you know, the Vatican is an institution with many layers of bureaucracy. And so the guys who are writing these letters, they got a lot of friends in the Curia. The Curia is basically the Vatican bureaucracy. It's sort of like the cabinet, you know. But it's also sort of like the CIA in that it's a permanent government in a sense. So they still have friends in high places. And unless the Pope can do some reform of the Curia and also continue to reinforce his message that he delivered when he spoke to the Jesuit journalist, we'll see just much of the same in the U.S. Church. It's got to be a full-on offensive. I do think this Pope is very clever. I think that he understands the public relations disaster that is befalling the U.S. Church, especially as it makes common cause with the Tea Party movement.
Well, Adele Stan, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is RH Reality Check's senior Washington correspondent. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.